Welcome to the Trade Securely Podcast.
When you look at your business assets, do you feel certain that they are adequately protected against unforeseen circumstances? No doubt you've insured your building, equipment, perhaps your key personnel, but what about your receivables? If your customer or customers are unable to pay you for the goods and services you provide, how would that impact your business? How would you pay your own bills if you can't collect on your receivables? Companies use receivables or credit insurance to protect against this type of loss. But for many, they see receivables insurance as a necessary cost of doing business. On this episode of the Trade Securely podcast, we're going to look at how to really do the math on the value of the coverage provided by your policy. I'm Janet Eastman. Welcome to the podcast. My guest today is Ryan Cummings. He's head of short-term multi-buyer trade credit at Zurich North America. Ryan, thanks very much for joining me.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
I think this will be a great conversation to get people to sort of change their perspective on, as you say, the cost of receivables insurance. So let's start at the beginning. And what are some of the things that a company should actually consider when they're determining the type of an RI policy that's going to be right for them?
Yeah, you know, I've seen this actually from both sides of the fence. I was a broker in my prior life, and I'm now an underwriter. I've noticed a few things over time that I think are really crucial for somebody to go in and evaluate. Really, it comes down to knowing your own company. So I think you want to look at what are the objectives of your company. So knowing what is the short-term and long-term plan of your company so that you can line up the coverage with what you're trying to achieve. What is the objective of purchasing the coverage is probably also another thing. So are you looking for it for financing? Are you looking for it for risk mitigation, sales expansion, et cetera? If it is for financing, you know, what is the financing company requiring? Is there something that could get you better financing and improve the offering? So maybe they're looking for certain terms within the policy, and obviously that's what you would want to go in knowing that if you have a deductible, it may impact your financing capabilities for some reason. And then I would say probably the last point is obviously a crucial one in knowing what are your company's comfort levels with risk, and also as far as the budget goes, because obviously those will both factor into what the offering can provide to you.
Right. Okay, so let's elaborate a little bit on some of the different limits. There's a cancelable limit and there's a non-cancelable limit. So what's the difference here?
Sure. So like you say, there's two different types of limits. What you see under a traditional ground-up model is that there are cancelable limits. We do write this a bit on the excess of loss side, but normally we go towards a non-cancelable limit. So I have to say that Zurich is on the non-can side, but I do tend to know both sides from my brokerage background. So the idea behind a cancelable limit is that you're more or less seeing a company step in as a more or less your credit management team. So they will go through, perform the underwriting as you may or may not, depending on how your company is structured. And they would advise you if they see a deterioration in the risk. So there's two sides to this. Anything that is in place before they would advise of a cancellation will remain in place. It doesn't affect your prior coverage. But going forward, they will give you a date that coverage would no longer apply, and any sales after that point would no longer apply to the policy. So some customers feel that that ends up leaving them exposed, but others also see a lot of value in the fact that it provides them with an outsourcing essentially of their credit management function and could possibly protect them from losses. Okay. The flip side of that is the excess of loss side, where we write non-cancelable limits. And I think from that, it's more a factor of us getting comfortable with our insured. And we typically have smaller teams, so we try to write fewer amount of limits. The idea being that with the old 80-20 rule, that you can capture about 80% of the sales with capturing 20% of the customers. We're really looking to step in and say, let's capture the large exposures, and we'll leave it to you to underwrite the lower exposures under what's called a discretionary credit limit, or a DCL. And then through that, there would be an associated deductible that would go along with it, with sharing the pen, so to speak, you writing your own risk. So with those limits, they would be in place for a specified period of time. So we would say for the limits that we're writing, they will be a one-year tenor generally. If there's a particularly tough buyer, it might be a shorter tenor because we want to watch it or maybe get more updated financial information. But the idea is once that limit is in place, you can trust that it's in place. We can't remove it by any means. The one subjectivity that I would add is that there's always a duty for the insured to act as if they are uninsured. So if there is a massive deterioration in the buyer and you're more or less shipping into a known loss at that point, then we would say that's something that you should exit. But I think there are many buyers, and one that I bring up as a good case study is Toys R Us, in the fact that they deteriorated and, you know, we were on risk for them. We saw them deteriorating, but we thought that there was sufficient time to remain on cover before they would file for bankruptcy, with retail companies typically filing post holiday season. But they had some events that escalated pretty quickly, and they ended up filing in, I believe it was September. So it kind of caught everybody by guard, off guard, and there ended up being some claims payments in the industry. So, you know, I think it's something that we don't want to ship into a known loss, but there are a lot of things that certainly come up and catch you off guard.
Right. So what is a couple of points that you've made here is that you talk about a time limit. So I guess when we're talking about receivables insurance, the insurance runs for a specified time limit, which is probably approximately a year. Is that the longest time period? Like, we're not talking about things that go out for 3 years. We're talking about a year or less for receivables insurance.
Typically under a multi-buyer policy, correct. So what we would normally see is you might have different terms on the structure of the policy. You may have a two-year policy, but generally the limits will remain in place for 1 year. More so under the non-can structure, whereas under a cancelable structure, it may be longer for the fact that they could get out of the limit, you know, at any time if they saw a deterioration. You may see on a single buyer basis a little bit different, that there may be extended tenors. You know, I've seen those go 5 or 7 years, but when you're dealing in kind of the world that we're talking about today, you're insuring your whole portfolio. It's typically a 1 year rolling policy.
Okay, fair enough. So you did mention a couple of terms that people may not be familiar with. Let's explain the difference between a discretionary credit limit and a named limit and how this might impact the insured's purchasing decision.
Yeah, so I think just kind of touching again on the discretionary credit limit, like I mentioned before, this is the ability for you to take the pen in your own hands and essentially grant coverage, assume that those buyers meet your credit procedures, and have that apply to the policy. So the idea being that I think you should know what your credit practices are and what the adherence to those practices within your own company would be, because that'll really be the dictator on whether this would be the policy for you or not. So, you know, if you say, well, you know what, our credit procedures are a little hazy, we really don't have them written out, so maybe this wouldn't really apply for us, I think that would be a good assessment. Or, you know, the credit practices are in place, but, you know, we deviate from them from time to time, you know, under the policy and under the discretionary credit limit. We're expecting you to adhere to those policies. And if they say that you will do a certain amount of measures, that you would follow through on those measures. You know, one thing that I think, speaking to the difference between a discretionary credit limit and a named credit limit, a named is something that, as I mentioned before, you would submit them to us, we would review them, and, you know, whether that's cancelable or non-can, anything that would be reviewed by the underwriter would be considered a named limit. It would be specifically endorsed to your policy, where the discretionary limit would be something that is under your own accord.
Okay, and just clarify this for me, because when you say named, is that actually naming the customer that is being covered?
It is, yeah. So you would have, okay, an endorsement to your policy that would state the customer and what the limit granted to that customer is. Under a discretionary credit limit, we would say, let's just pick a hypothetical number and say $500,000. We would say that you can endorse customers without our supervision up to $500,000. So anything below that would be on your own credit procedures.
Okay. And can I have a policy that has both? Like I have some named and some discretionary?
Yeah, absolutely. So going back to the 80-20 rule that I mentioned before, you know, we would look to endorse about 20% of the customers, and the other 80 would probably be on your own accord. And we would see that in general, the policies that we write, we see about 80-85% of the sales flow through those 20%.
Okay, fair enough. That clarifies that for me. Thank you. So let's speak a little bit to the trade-off between the deductible versus the premium spend and what are the factors that may impact this decision? Because some people will take a higher deductible to keep their premium down, but maybe that's not really the best idea for them or vice versa, right?
Right. Yeah, I think it, going back to kind of my initial comments, it's always about what your company feels is right for them. You know, what is your own risk tolerance? If your company feels comfortable taking on a large deductible because they feel very comfortable with the risk, then there may be a benefit to the premium. You know, one of the things that I would always look towards is what are the historical losses and the likelihood of future losses under that your buyer base? And I think that's a good indicator of what you should expect, what you could take on, because essentially what you're doing is a calculation of deductible plus premium equals cost. You know, if you're not expecting to utilize that deductible, then that brings down that cost. You know, I would say you're always walking a balance between the break even of retained losses and premium. And if you have a deductible in place because it's more of a risk mitigation factor that you don't expect to use, then that obviously brings down the retained losses factor in that equation. You know, one thing that I do like touching on, though, because a lot of people don't necessarily give it credence, is that there are what I would call quasi-deductibles out there. And these would be things like limit cancellations, non-approvals of limits, and even non-qualifying losses. So what would also be termed as an NQL on a policy. And I'll just briefly touch on that. So that's a threshold under which losses would not apply. It's more or less deemed to be like a nuisance claim where it's not really material to the policy and it's more trading of dollars. So it would be almost the form of a per loss deductible under your auto policy where they say for $500 or less, we're not too concerned about this. Don't bother submitting it.
Okay.
So with those, the idea being that they're things that you will retain on your own account, whether it's a limit cancellation, a non-approval, a non-qualifying loss. And it's valuable for people to really bring that into their calculation of what their true retained losses would be. So for any buyer that's not approved under your policy, obviously that stays on your own balance sheet if there was a loss rather than being transferred to the insurer. So when comparing two quotes, I think it's valuable to look at what each carrier is offering and really getting an understanding, particularly if you're looking at a ground up policy versus a excess of loss policy, what each carrier is bringing to the table. If there's a lot of limits approved under a ground up policy, then there's probably not a whole lot of value in taking on the discretionary credit limit and the deductible that's accompanying that, outside of pure flexibility of your business practices. But from a true cost perspective, if there are buyers that are not being covered under a ground-up policy, and maybe that excess of loss discretionary model might fit for you, it's something that you should look and say, well, if I was to have losses on these five buyers, it could amount to X amount in premium, and therefore that's an additional cost that I have to retain for myself and factor that in as a deductible.
Right. Okay. Okay. So I actually host a podcast for the manufacturing sector. And in that podcast, we talk a lot about how the business landscape is constantly changing, but it has really been evolving in the 21st century. And it's having quite an impact on how people go about doing their business. I'm wondering if business sentiment that you've seen has changed towards bankruptcy in the last few years, and are companies now using it as a tool to restructure? Has that sense of shame about bankruptcy diminished so that they can, you know, use it to restructure and then eliminate their losses and move on, and that's how they're going about business? And should this be a red flag to people out there?
Yes, so this is actually a very interesting topic to talk about. So my father was actually in the industry for 40 some odd years, and he always said that he didn't necessarily have 40 years of experience, but he had it about, you know, 10 years, four times over. because the industry really changes a lot in a period. You know, we've seen it quite a bit from 2009 to now. It's a whole different world. You know, I think as far as how that relates to bankruptcies and maybe what companies use them, how they use them as a restructuring tool, you know, I think there are a lot of companies that you could look towards. Many of the airlines, for example, have gone into bankruptcy, restructured, and emerged, you know, stronger. You know, is that to say that everybody does that? Absolutely not. You know, I wouldn't suggest people going into bankruptcy, of course, but, you know, I do think that there is less shame, as you said, about it than there was in the past. You know, as far as what we've seen, it's a bit interesting with claims in the recent past, where what I would say 10 years ago is that it was very much a death by a thousand cuts. You saw a lot of insolvencies, but they were for relatively low amounts, but they would stack up to be very large numbers. What we're seeing now is that there tend to be fewer bankruptcies in number, but the dollar amounts tend to be much higher. So you're finding a lot of large companies going insolvent, and it still produces a very high level of losses. So I guess the moral of that is, you know, when what we're seeing now is that when something does hit, it hits much harder and it hurts a bit more. As far as, you know, kind of looking forward, we are in a situation now where, you know, I think from Zurich's end, we are projecting that there very may well be a recession in the near future. Looking back over the past 40 or 50 years, we're typically finding that there's a recession about every 8 years. And obviously, we spoke to 2009, you know, we're now coming up on about 10 years from then. So you would expect one to be coming based on historical trends. And I have to say that Zurich's own economist has said that he is projecting a downturn as well.
That's kind of scary when you think about it. Every 8 years, it's like, how do you even dig yourself out of a hole, you know, depending on how big the hole is, in an 8 year span, and get ready to ride out another one? That's crazy.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it goes back to how quickly you recover in between. I would say that's, for me personally, that's one of the things that I look at that I'm a little bit concerned about, is that I don't necessarily know if we ever recovered to pre-recession levels, and that can make the next recession a bit tougher.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so are there any other considerations that the insured should contemplate when reviewing their options and thinking about an RI policy?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think I see a consistent trend with me going back to knowing your company, right? And
yeah.
I think looking at your business, it's something where, do you have different types of business within your own company? So I always use an example of maybe a machinery manufacturer that they sell machinery, but they also sell parts. So there's a lot of flexibility in policies where you can kind of customize them for yourself and say, well, you know, I have this large deductible on my machinery, but I would never get a payout under a parts loss. So does it make sense to have one deductible for your machinery sales and another for parts sales? You know, we see a lot of multinational companies that purchase this insurance. And, you know, is there different ways of doing business in one geographic region than another, where it may require you to have different payment terms or different structure in place? So I would say that's something that you'd want to look at and really determine what is the structure of the policy, and how does that affect the structure of your company? You know, another thing I would look at is specific accounts in your portfolio that you're looking for coverage, and really putting a prioritization on those. So one of the factors that when we're underwriting, we determine what the risk is on various companies and bring that together into the policy. You know, I think insurers should do the same thing, in that there's certain prioritization on buyers. And if there's one buyer that is a particular risk that you are concerned about for various reasons. So let's take a fairly benign reason, say that it's because it represents 20% of your sales volume. And if that company was to go down and create major cash flow issues for your company, you know, that's something that I would say you probably want to put a higher prioritization on that risk, just saying that this is one that has really meaningful consequences for me, whereas somebody else who doesn't have major consequences, probably not as valuable. So if one customer, one company is giving you more coverage or less coverage on that, you should take that into your determination.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, are most companies looking at receivables insurance as a business cost? But it is a tool for growth, right? So, I mean, when you are actually sitting down, considering whether or not you're going to get an RI policy, how should you view this as a business?
You know, I think what's always left in the insurance equation, because I think a lot of people look at the typical auto insurance or maybe property insurance, is that this is an opportunity to possibly grow your sales as well. So are there opportunities for you to expand your business? One of the things that we see fairly often is that maybe there are mergers that you might look at, but you're concerned about bringing in the additional receivables exposure that would come to certain customers, and it would go past your comfort levels. Or maybe you've been always dealing in the US and Canada, and you're thinking about going into Mexico, but you don't know the business climate well there. You know, I think that's where the insurers can come in, provide a bit more comfort, both with their expertise, because I think that's something that we definitely provide as far as our knowledge of these industries, but also from the risk side and mitigating some of that risk. And I think the thing for me is always looking at what are the potential profits that you could gain out of that if you're able to expand that sales base into a new area, and trying to balance that against the cost of the coverage. So, you know, just kind of looking at it and saying, well, if I make X amount more in sales and I know my margins are X percent, then I can figure out that I'm almost paying for the cost of this policy, or at worst, you know, minimizing the cost. So, you know, I think that's something that's always forgotten, but it's a very meaningful aspect of the coverage.
Right. And according to statistics, it looks like in Canada, most Canadian businesses have their receivables account for about 40% of their assets, right? And if there is no coverage on that and something goes wrong, then you've got this massive exposure. And the other thing about receivables insurance that I always think is very interesting is that the insights that the providers can give you into the credit activities of the companies you might be considering doing business with. So you can actually gain some valuable insight by having this tool in your pocket.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that starts on the front end with the credit assessment, but it also carries on throughout the policy. So this isn't the type of policy that you put on a shelf and, you know, only pull out when you have a claim. You use this policy during the life of the you use the benefit during the life of the policy. And, you know, it's something that we can adjust limits during the course of the year. It's meant to be fluid because obviously trade is fluid. Mm-hmm. But, you know, also when there are tougher situations that pop up, maybe somebody is having slow payments. We have access to many customers and we might have knowledge from one customer versus another and might be able to advise our insurers how to handle something. Or in the worst case scenario, when we do have claims, we do have, you know, sophisticated claims teams that are very well versed in handling insolvencies and past due situations. So they can definitely provide a lot of insight into recovering as much of that claim as possible.
Right. Ryan, thank you very much for your insights. It's been a really interesting conversation, and I hope that people gain some information there that they can use to support their business. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Ryan Cummings is the head of short-term multi-buyer trade credit at Zurich North America. So if you have questions about receivables insurance, please contact a member of the Receivables Insurance Association of Canada, of which Zurich is a member. You can find them listed on the member section of the Receivables Insurance Canada.com. You can also find out more information, on receivables insurance on the website or at our news site, tradesecurely.ca. I'm Janet Eastman. Thanks very much for listening to the Trade Securely podcast.